Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Live link here at thetrumpet.com. Coming up on today's program, the Fed has hiked the interest rates. How will this affect you? Good question. Also, why you should drop the, quote, can't stop, won't stop mentality when it comes to working. People are getting overworked, and they say it's not a good thing. And also, dark matter drought hits older galaxies. Pretty interesting story about what's going on up there in space. If you're interested in that, I think you'll like this story. That and more, this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We are online, too, at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com. Thanks for listening in those various locations. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau here today. And lots to talk about today, lots happening out there, so we'll get right into it. You guys ready?
I think so.
Yes.
Whether you are or not, it's going to happen. There's a story here about this just happened recently. France, it's school shootings, hit the U.S. a lot, but they hit other parts of the country, too. This is one that happened here just in the last few hours. Says France suspect arrested after shooting at Grazi School, I believe it's pronounced. One person has been arrested after a shooting at a high school in the town of Grazi, southeast France, authorities said Thursday. 17-year-old armed with a rifle, a handgun, a revolver, and two grenades. Boy, oh boy. Entered the Alexis de Tocqueville school at about lunchtime and opened fire at the head teacher, according to CNN's French affiliate, BFM TV. Eight people have been injured, including those just with shock, which you could imagine would happen. A French Interior Ministry spokesman said the person arrested wasn't known to police. Authorities said the attack was not considered a terrorism incident. They're still looking into it. Something went wrong at that school. Thankfully, no one killed yet, apparently. But crazy. This happens every once in a while. We see it here in the U.S., but other parts of the world are not immune either. So this happened in France today.
Yeah, and it sounds like he came really equipped to sort of carry out a massacre, like in a video game or something like that.
Yeah, rifle, handgun, revolver, two grenades. Unbelievable. That's it's always amazing to me. I never, in all my years of going to school, I graduated in 97 from high school, never once considered that. Certainly personally, I wouldn't do it. But I just mean in general. I never went to school thinking like, oh, would somebody do something like that? Furthest thing from my mind. And it's not that there weren't problems here and there, disagreements and things. But like this is just next level. And really, since Columbine, that seems like it's just been in the news every couple months or years.
Yeah, it's a terrible trend of our modern society. And it's and just looking, when people look back on us, when they read our history, it's going to be a pretty bad stain that every few months there's kids killing other kids or adults. And I've just been reading a lot about the Victorian era lately, and the headmasters of those schools, they would, because they had corporal punishment, you could spank the kid or they'd use like a whip or a paddle. And some of those kids would bleed and different things like that. And I think there's obviously a line they stepped over too many times, and it caused deep resentment in the kids, and it broke some kids. But there weren't any school shootings back then. And so I think there's different mentality, you can't really compare the two, I guess, but it's just completely different society, and that we come to expect this, and it's normal nowadays.
Yeah, and of course that was years ago, so they wouldn't have had probably access to some of the same weaponry either. But at the same time, yeah, you didn't see things like this very often.
Yeah, well, back then too, though, the teachers were allowed to sort of be the parent. If the parent was neglecting the kid at home, then they wouldn't be able to just slip by at school undetected, which it seems like it's able to happen now because the teacher is worried about correcting the student in any way or else they'll get fired. And there's always people videotaping a stern correction, and so teachers can't really do much about it. It's really up to the parents now to make sure the family's right.
Yeah, that's what you don't really hear with these stories is the sort of like the aftermath report. What was the child's home life like? What situations were they involved in? So, but I'm sure they'll look at some of those things. And there's a lot of good write-ups at thetrumpet.com about the cause of school violence, why that occurs. So you can check those out at thetrumpet.com. Gets more in-depth in that. Here's a story from yahoo.com. This will affect probably all of us. If you deal in money, if you were in the bartering system, you'll probably be fine. But I don't know too many that are. This is this is the title of the article is, "Here's How the Fed Rate Hike Affects You." The Federal Reserve has raised interest rates for the first time in 2017, citing economic progress, raising the federal funds rate a quarter percentage point to a range between 0.75% and 1%. The Fed also indicated it would raise rates twice more this year. So more rises are on the horizon, apparently. And so they go through a few things that this could affect. And so this will affect a lot of our listeners, and it will affect all of us, again, because we use money. Mortgages, what's going to happen there? They say mortgages that don't have fixed rates are always susceptible to rate hikes. Small bumps make a big difference. For example, a 0.75 difference on a $200,000 loan means spending $100 more a month. Ba-bum-bum. In mortgages. That's amazing. I mean, yeah. You know, if you got your monthly budget plan, all of a sudden there's $100 gone just because of the rate change. That's a problem. They say, so if you're in the market for a mortgage or know you will be soon, it's a good idea to start shopping. Mortgage rates have already been climbing higher in the last few months. The 30-year fixed rate rose to a nearly 3-year high last week. So people have different thoughts about mortgages, and some people, you know, would feel different ways about it. Typically, you kind of like to get a fixed rate because you don't want it bouncing around on you.
Yeah, what stood out to me when I heard that they were raising the rates was that they were doing it because the economy was growing too fast. So maybe that makes sense to experts, but it's like they're trying to slow down the growth of the economy by raising the rates. I don't really get it, and maybe to someone who knows more, they could explain that. It just doesn't make much sense to me.
Somebody wants more money.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Like, this is too good. We're having too much good in the economy right now, and so we're going to try and dampen that a little bit.
A lot of people got into trouble in 2008 or so when the housing bubble burst, which, by the way, they think there's another one coming from an article I read earlier today. But, you know, people got into these mortgages that would move around, and, you know, the first year or two would be steady, and then it would shift. And so the thought was, okay, you can buy a house on the cheap and it'll increase in value. So before your mortgage resets, you can sell it and make money. And some people did. They could turn it around. You buy a house you can't afford technically, but you can afford the smaller payment up front and sell it in 2 years when the price jumps, you know, $20,000, and you just made cash. Mm-hmm. So it did work for some people, but then some people got caught holding the bag or got caught with mortgages that they couldn't afford. And those are a disaster to get out of, and that really hit a lot of people in 2008.
Yeah, in Canada, actually, because that's the housing bubble rose faster in Canada. It didn't burst not like it did in the States, but I remember in a newspaper there was reading about a couple. They were both doctors. So they made huge amounts of money. They had to live in a van because they couldn't afford to get a mortgage with both of them working in Calgary.
Well, yeah.
It was just ridiculous. And they were both honest people, have really good jobs, and they just couldn't afford it.
Sounds like San Francisco right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To where you have these tech workers making good money and they can barely afford to live anywhere. Certainly not close to work. How will the Fed rate increase affect savings accounts? They say the most immediate impacts from the Federal Reserve's decision to hike rates will be felt more among borrowers than savers. Isn't that always the way? Mark Hamrick, a senior economic analyst at Bankrate.com, told Yahoo Finance last year that it can take a long time for the higher interest rates to trickle to savings accounts. Research by the Fed found that slow reactions from savings account rates cost savers $100 billion per year. That's not going to be all on my account. But according to Hammer, 2017 changes could finally result in better rate of return. So it's interesting. If you owe money and the rate changes, you immediately feel it, what you have to pay. But what you're saving, well, that'll trickle down. That'll take a while.
Yet debt is glorified in this society like it's somewhat fashionable and it will get you everything you want. Yeah, but you're subject to all these volatile changes. You don't really have a whole lot of stability at all.
That's right. Yeah, it becomes you can get yourself in a really bad situation. How's it going to affect credit cards? They say like adjustable rate mortgages, a rate hike can affect a credit card APR quick as a month. And as interest rates rise, the APR, the annual percentage rate, which you pay on your credit card balance, rises too. However, they are likely to feel small because they already charge you so much interest. you're already getting taken. So the extra rate, it's a little more, but it's not. You know, you won't feel it as much as you will, like say, in a mortgage or something like that. How does it affect car and college loans? According to Bankrate, rate hikes don't affect car loans particularly quickly. Particularly if you've got a fixed rate, I guess. They say, and since college loans are often fixed, they are unaffected by the Fed's rate hikes. However, future college borrowers may be affected. So if you already have those loans, probably not going to do much to them. However, those that are looking for either whether it's a new mortgage or you're looking for a college loan or you're looking for a car loan, now you're going to start to pay more because the rates have gone up.
Yeah, it's a bad time to be a young person, I think, because whether you're trying to get a house or, anyone looking to purchase something, you're just going to get dinged. And then in a few years, if it goes down again, then you just overspent on something because the rate went up. So it'd just be interesting to see if they're trying to slow the growth of the economy, I think they'll succeed in any event.
Well, it's interesting, too, because the a car depreciates quickly, you know. So if you're really on the hook for that, it's a depreciating asset. Education kind of depends. it could be a depreciating asset, I guess, depending on what you spent your time on. And, you know, houses sometimes do increase in value, but it depends. It depends on the economy. So pretty interesting there. And a lot is happening. I mean, as much as some of President Trump's ideas are being shot down in the media, like the travel bans and so forth, a lot of what he is doing is moving things one way or the other, whether it be like with, say, even immigration to an extent, even though they've shut down some things. But the economy, it is improving in some ways. And then this comes along as well. So there is a lot that is happening. It does seem like the media is trying to make it out like nothing's happening. Things are happening, whether they're good or bad, I guess that remains to be seen. But there is movement out there in a lot of these areas that we haven't seen a lot of movement in a while.
Yeah, it has been a really efficient presidency in terms of him seemingly doing several tangible things every single day. And I guess he's been criticized for going down to Florida to do some of those dealings, but he's still doing a lot. And whether it's good or bad, he is still doing a lot. And a lot of it is good. I mean, at least with the illegal immigration and things like that, that would prioritize the American worker, at least.
There is a tweet that McDonald's sent out was big news against the president. I'm not going to get into it because it's just ridiculous. But anyway, they're pretty negative. And it's really interesting how businesses are kind of getting political in a way. I assume their assumption, that's an interesting thing to say, that they think people are going to agree with them. It's going to be good for business. But I saw an interesting story yesterday. They were talking about basketball, the NBA versus the NFL. And even though NFL ratings were down last year, the NBA is bottoming out and people aren't talking about it. The viewership is down almost 30%. So they're losing money. And what the commentators were asking is the NBA too political? And a lot of them said yes. They thought it was. And they said they don't understand their market. They don't understand who they're selling the product to. The people that they're selling the product to aren't interested in their politics. And I think that's a good point for the NBA or for any business. A lot of people don't necessarily agree with a very strong political stance. You're going to alienate at least half of the people that might come to your business or watch your product or buy your product.
Yeah, and in the case of McDonald's, you would think that a lot of McDonald's workers might agree with someone like Mr. Trump and his job policies as well. So it's like they're even slapping their own workers in the face.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, if you're hiring thousands and hundreds of thousands of people, I don't know how many they hire. Not everyone's going to agree, and once you start getting into that, it's going to cause some offense. So it is interesting to see what happens with some of that. It's a very political cycle. It's amazing. And I can't remember it being that way last. You know, it seems like I really liked the one commentator. He said he made this really good analogy. He said, look, I like tuna fish sandwiches. I like ice cream. I don't like them together. He said, I like politics. I like NBA basketball. I don't like them together. That's
such,
perfect.
That is such a perfect point. That's exactly right. And it is important for people to consider their demographic, like you said. I mean, a lot of it's coming from people who might not be too vocal on Twitter, but they're definitely giving you the money, and that's what you need to think about.
Yep. So pretty interesting there. Here's a good story from CNN.com. You know, you can feel like you're getting old. Even you guys, you're a little younger. I'm younger too. You can feel like you're starting to get a little older. But then every once in a while you see somebody that is older, but they're just doing incredible things. 70-year-old woman runs 7 marathons on 7 continents in 7 days. It's like the perfect sevens there. Running 4 marathons in 5 weeks wasn't enough. They say running 10 marathons in a year wasn't enough. Running more than 70 marathons during her lifetime wasn't enough. 70-year-old Chow Smith wanted to challenge herself even further, so she decided to run 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents. In January, the Missouri woman accomplished that goal. Between January 25th and January the 31st, Smith ran marathons in Perth, Australia, Singapore, Cairo, Amsterdam, Garden City, New York, Punta Arenas, Chile, and King George Island, Antarctica. That'd be fascinating, run in Antarctica. Past the penguins.
You can just slide. You don't even need to run.
Take one step and you're there. Yeah. You just slide the rest of the way. Each day, Smith woke up. Keep in mind, she's 70 years old. Each day, Smith woke up and ran 26.2 miles. Then she'd get on a plane, fly to the next destination to do it all over again. It would be taxing to just take that trip. 7 continents in 7 days. Just to take the trip would be taxing. Very taxing. And yet, she ran a marathon at 70 years old in each of those continents. Can you believe that?
That's such a packed schedule because each of those destinations are so far apart. It's almost like run, fly 7 times in a row. I mean, there's almost no downtime in between the run itself and the flight.
Yeah.
You have to be pretty much, I guess, sleeping on the plane the whole time, hopefully.
I would think so. You know, and if you exercise a lot and you get that leg cramp or Charlie horse or something on the plane, what are you going to do? 9 other people joined Smith in running on all 7 continents. Although she had done many marathons before, training to run 7 in a row took months. She said, it took me 8 months to really train. The last 4 months I really put in long, long runs. Every week I ran from 15 to 130 miles. So that's quite a difference.
Yeah.
What am I going to run this week, 15 or 130?
She's 15.
That's amazing. You know, I think about that sometimes. Like, I thought about that actually when I was driving back from Dallas recently. You hit those signs that say 120 miles to Oklahoma City or whatever. And I know that people run that, like, in the course of a week. And yeah. Then I think, wow, like, if I had to start out and run all the way back, like, I think I would just die on the spot. You know, it seems like so far, but people do that. It's crazy. And she's 70.
Yeah, I think for her, the training, it's not necessarily the physical training, it's the mental training. Because I think anyone who runs or has run, I think they understand that it's all about mind power, being able to stay concentrated on a goal, not panicking, not being discouraged at the distance left. And so if you can master your concentration and have the right kind of motivation, I guess, that you need for your goals, you can probably do it. So with all the traveling involved, climatizing the different temperatures and everything, all those different countries, I mean, it takes just mental dexterity, unbelievable mental dexterity to be able to do it. I think physically, a lot of people could, if they're able to unlock their mental capacity and their concentration to do it.
If you want to try it, the challenge is called the 777 Quest. That's what they call it. Presented a unique set of obstacles because, like you were saying, Abraham, that it wasn't just the running. During the first race in Australia, the temperature was above 100 degrees. So if you can imagine that, she became severely sunburned. The most challenging race was in Cairo. The group's connecting flight from Singapore was delayed in Abu Dhabi. They arrived in Egypt only a few minutes to change before heading to the race start. She said, we had 10 minutes to go up to our rooms to change. We couldn't unpack. The key wasn't working for my room. I almost used up my 10 minutes. She said, I was crying. Most of the runners had had a set time in which to finish each race in order to pace themselves for all 7. Smith had allotted herself 7 hours to finish the race in Cairo, but because of the delay, she was told that she'd have to finish in 6. And Smith was worried, this other one that was with him, worried about finishing time, and or sorry, this Smith is a runner. There's this other person here that suggested she run the half marathon instead just to get it done. And she said, no way. She finished the full marathon in 5 hours and 51 minutes. And she said, from that day on, they never asked me about thinking about running a half marathon again. So she did it. That's pretty just astounding that somebody could do that at any age, let alone at 70 years of age. So congratulations to her.
Yeah, sounds like a reality show waiting to be made. Someone following them around.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be, I would watch that.
That would be incredible. You wouldn't even have to, like, make the drama, make it up, because sometimes they kind of make up the drama. There'd be enough drama there, especially being late on the flight and all that. That'd be fascinating to watch.
Yeah. You could make that into a blockbuster movie, even more than a reality show, I would think, because whoever at that age does something like that, it's just so rare, and it's almost like most writers wouldn't think to write a story like that, and yet it's actually real.
It seems unbelievable.
Yeah.
People would say that's just unbelievable. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. The Key of David program's coming up in a bit. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. And make sure you stop and check out thetrumpet.com. Video up there today, discussion, Scotland's referendum and the end of Britain. Brad McDonald and Richard Palmer there, discussing it on video. Pretty interesting. Make sure you check that out. Grant, you've got a story for us here from Forbes, why you should drop the can't stop, won't stop mentality and find success.
Yes, this article starts out with an interesting story of someone who's been working really hard over time on all these projects with tight deadlines. The problem is every time before this person is able to finish a certain project, another one's assigned, and then she'll go into the boss's office and he has this thing on his desk that says can't stop, won't stop. So she realizes that all the projects overlap. There's never going to be a break from all this. So she's kind of feeling hopeless, which is understandable.
You know, it just occurred to me that that's a line from a Miley Cyrus song.
That is. That's a great point.
How do I know that? Why do I know that?
I'll just say that I didn't know that. So.
I don't know why I know that. I don't know much about her at all, but that phrase, I was like, I've heard that before somewhere, and then the refrain kind of
so
kicked
true.
Into my head.
I never thought of that.
It must be like kind of a famous saying. You know, like you have those, what do they call them, like those encouraging posters you'll see around, you know, can't stop, won't stop. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's something like that. But anyway, the point is that they're trying to make is that mentality only gets you so far, and then you burn out at some point.
Right, and that's one of the main dangers of that. They say that you should stop doing this, stop using this method of working to extremes at all hours as hard as you can without breaks for several reasons. The first one is that great work comes from tweaks and fixes. So if you don't have any breaks, you don't have any chance to consider what you just did, improve the process, and do it better the next time. You're just rushed right on to the next thing.
That's a really good point about the tweaks and the fixes. Ryan Malone, who does Music for Life here on Trumpet Radio, he in his latest show, he talked about an example where they told students to either spend the whole semester, I think it was, making one clay pot, or just make as many as you could. And they found out that those who made as many as they could, actually they were better towards the end because they kept tweaking it as they went and kept experimenting. And that's how you learn, as opposed to just sitting there, you know, focusing on this one particular thing. And he was making a point about you need practice. You have to practice things. So that kind of ties into that as well, that you, but again, even with practice, you've got to take a break, come back to it, tweak it, fix it, and you get a better product at the end a lot of times.
That is a really thought-provoking example there, because I would have thought it would be the exact opposite. If you were focusing all your time and energy on the one thing, that it would be better than any of those hastily put together pots. But yeah, that's a really great point, that if you just keep on repeating the process but improving it every time, then there are going to be some measurable improvements, and that's something that the boss would appreciate more than just hammering away for 16 hours a day and never stopping.
Yeah, because I think some points, you know, you have to present something and say, well, this is what I did. You know, hey, it wasn't perfect. Well, it's something. You know, and then you could tweak it from there. But that's an interesting point about getting back again to this article about the can't stop, won't stop mentality and why it hurts people.
Yes, and the second point why you shouldn't have that mentality at work is that you pay a price for compressed schedules. It talks about how producing spectacular results actually takes time. And if you're just having this really compressed schedule, you're just going to make a ton of tiny mistakes along the way instead of actually doing it well the first time. And once you've reached the end of the project, you're also going to have to budget time for going back and fixing all the mistakes that were made. If you, obviously, if you're not getting enough sleep and you're working too long and you're rushing yourself and you're trying to meet these impossible deadlines, mistakes are going to pop up everywhere.
Yeah, and it kind of, that kind of speaks even to the idea of multitasking. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about that lately because I find that when I multitask, which you can't really do, studies have found, inevitably you kind of make mistakes somewhere in that process, as opposed to just saying, okay, I want to do this one thing, try to get it done, then move to the next project. And that comes up at all points in life. I was talking to my son about that because of homework and all these other things. And, you know, you can run around trying to do it all at once, and that by the end you think, well, what did I even do? I didn't even get anything done. As opposed to just taking one thing at a time and then moving on and not trying to compress everything into this small period of time.
Yeah, it's about being sort of methodical and measured about what's going on instead of clumping all these things together and looking at this mass of assignments that have to be done. It looks really intimidating when they're all put together, but when you separate them out and you approach them as one tiny object at a time, it's actually a whole lot easier.
Yeah. What other points do they bring up here about trying to not have this can't stop, won't stop approach to work?
The third point of why to avoid that approach is that creating a feedback loop takes time and reaps rewards. So this is talking about how instead of just plowing forward on a project, find out what people think, whether it's friends, family, coworkers, people you barely talk to but are distant acquaintances. Find out what everyone is thinking about your different ideas and then apply that feedback into the project. You know, I think about all the different enterprises that could really benefit from that right now. A lot of the, you know, like a Twitter account attacking Mr. Trump. If people would take a second to ask how that would come off to most people, probably something like that wouldn't be tweeted. And that's really damaging to the entire business to do something like that. Get feedback from a variety of different people with different viewpoints to see what will be best received by most people.
Right. And I think probably a danger in that is you have to make sure your feedback loop doesn't become an echo chamber.
Right.
To where
exactly.
You're just talking to people that have the exact same thinking you do, which is the natural thing to sort of do. But then you don't really get any other input.
Right. It does specify that. Make sure each time you're on a new project, reach out to different people. Don't just talk to your best friends who believe every single thing down to a T that you believe, or else obviously they're going to be gung-ho about whatever project you're doing as well. They're not going to have any critiques, but critiques are what help people improve.
Yeah, for sure. Was there another point or two?
There's two more.
Okay.
Yeah. Four, burnout is your worst enemy. So this is pretty obvious. There have been a lot of studies about decreased productivity. People who work too much, sometimes working 80 hours a week, they're getting less done than people who just work the regular 40-hour full-time work week. They're more refreshed each day. They're more encouraged to go to work instead of seeing no light at the end of the tunnel. So they're actually able to do more in less time.
Yeah, you can get to that point where you're just kind of, like it says, burnt out. your brain isn't processing at the proper speeds. And so, you know, it's always, I don't know if this is my saying or maybe somebody else has it, but I use it. I say, don't be in a hurry to make a mistake. Mm. Probably somebody else has said that, but we talk about that whenever we're, particularly, you know, if we're playing sports like baseball or something with the little league team that I work with or other things, you know, people want to, the kids especially, they just want to do something really quick. And it's like, but don't be in a hurry to make a mistake, because when you're trying to do things too fast, you just have an error. Mm-hmm. And there's no value in it. You might as well take your time and make the right play in the case of baseball.
Yeah, right. Like instead of letting three runs score by throwing to the wrong base, just take a second longer, throw the right one. Maybe only one run will score.
Right.
And that applies to life as well. Just reevaluating schedules, it talks about here, creating a new and different routine that is less exhaustive, for example, and then maybe even having a positive mantra for when times get really challenging, something like always keep moving forward. You know, something to make you think about pushing through, even if mistakes are made, going on to the next thing, figuring out and doing better.
Or you can do the Seinfeld one, serenity now, insanity later. For those that are familiar with that expression. And the final point.
The final point is if you can't stop, won't stop. You're not building bridges, you're burning them. So this is talking about people always rushing around. They don't take time to show gratitude or show any sort of happiness or share happiness with others when a project is completed the right way. They're already on to the next one. They're already halfway on to the next one, and they're making more mistakes. So it's obviously bad in a lot of ways, but People who are constantly rushing, constantly making work their number one priority, are not developing any relationships. They're not good to be around. And that actually means that even if they are extremely productive, they're still probably less liked in the office than someone who actually takes the time to say hello.
Yeah, it's from Forbes.com, why you should drop the can't stop, won't stop mentality and find success. Some good points there. Probably extremes on both sides of that, where people, you know, work way too much and then some that just don't work much at all. Neither one of those is good. You got to find that that sweet spot in the middle, I guess.
Yeah, it's important not to mistake that last point, especially for just being the nice guy that does nothing and hoping that personality alone will carry you on to the promotion. Right. Obviously, you have to get some things done, but if you alienate everyone around you, you might still get fired even if you produce more than everyone else. That's the point.
Right. That's you know, actually that reminds me, I worked with a sales guy years ago. He was in the same office that I was. We didn't work directly together necessarily, but we all knew each other. And I do remember, like, unfortunately, the guy did lose his job, and the comment was made that he didn't know when to turn it off.
Mm.
Because he, as sales guys, you have to be selling. But he just could never stop. And so at the office, he was always trying, even though he wasn't trying to sell you anything, he just couldn't stop with the shtick, if you will.
You go out after work and he's trying to convince you to buy the same thing on the menu as he is.
It's just that, yeah, he just couldn't stop with it. I mean, I didn't have a lot of contact with him, didn't have much thought on it one way or the other, but that was, I remember that. That's mm-hmm. the comment that was made. So, yeah, a lot of stuff plays in there. It's pretty interesting. That's from Forbes.com. Why you should drop the can't stop, won't stop mentality and find success. Grant, thanks for bringing that to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. Have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And you can listen at the TuneIn app as well, which is a great place to listen. I'm Dwight Falk. Abraham Blondeau has a few interesting pieces for us here. This is from register.co.uk. For people that are really into space, what's going on up in space, this is pretty interesting. Dark matter drought hits older galaxies. They say study could explain how star systems go from amorphous blobs to beautiful spirals. So they're learning more about this, apparently.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating subject because I think everyone has heard of dark matter, but what is it? And how does it shape the universe? I think that's something that... We all wonder about once in a while or forget what the actual definition is. And the funny thing is that scientists actually don't know what it is either. But before going into how dark matter can shape galaxies, this article first talks about what dark matter is. And basically, in the 1970s, astronomers built these mathematical models. So when they observed a galaxy or the movement of stars, they could predict how fast they were moving and where they were going. So they had this mathematical model based on what they could observe already. But when they started looking further into the universe, to the outer reaches of the galaxy, so the further out stars, the stars were moving much faster than they had expected. And they couldn't. There were no physical reason to explain this. The math didn't add up. They couldn't explain why these stars were moving so quickly when all the physics they understood in the universe said they should be moving slower. And so over time, scientists came up with a theory that dark has to be another force not explained by math that is pushing these stars in a certain direction at a certain speed. And that's what dark matter is. So dark matter is the force in the universe that is moving galaxies, shaping galaxies that scientists cannot explain using math or physics.
Right. I was going to say, if I understand it correctly, it's like they know it's there because of the effects on things that they can see, but they can't really see the matter itself, the dark matter. They can't discern it other than it's affecting things. And because of the effect on things, they say there is something there causing that.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a not direct observation, it's indirect. They assume that since nothing they can observe is having an effect on a star or an object, then there must be another force that they cannot observe, and that's what dark matter is.
Right.
So it's an assumption, but that there is something there dark matter is the name they give it. It could be anything.
Right.
That's what they call it, dark matter.
Sounds cool.
Yeah. It's a good idea. But what they're observing now is they're starting to look further and further into the universe. And at the European Southern Observatory, they have a huge telescope there. And they're looking at galaxies formed about 10 billion years ago. So basically, the galaxies that are further away from us are older than the one that the Milky Way and the ones around us, that they have less dark matter than the newer galaxies. And they're intrigued by this because, again, it doesn't make sense. They would expect that as a galaxy matures, there's more dark matter because the dark matter has increasing influence on it. But as it turns out, it's the exact opposite, where these older galaxies that were created created first actually have less dark matter than the newer ones. So they're trying to figure out what this means because scientists believe that this might be a key to helping explain how and why galaxies are shaped a certain way. So with most galaxies are like the spiral. There's, I think, three or four different shapes that galaxies can come in. But how did all these stars become aligned in a certain formation? Why are they all clumped together or not floating off? Why aren't they crashing into each other? All that sort of thing. So they think that the key to understanding this is that as a galaxy matures, the dark matter goes away or there's less force acting on it. And so it changes shape into the older shapes compared to the newer ones, perhaps.
So there, but again, and it's an assumption. I mean, I suppose you could assume the other way and say maybe there just wasn't as much dark matter in that galaxy to begin with.
Right.
Because what they're not comparing the same galaxy over a period of time, right? They're comparing one that is older to one that is newer, but they're different. So, I mean, it's not a bad assumption that they have, but that was the first thing I thought of as well. Is it losing dark matter as it ages, or was there just not as much in there to begin with? Because, I mean, what's so fascinating about stars and things like that is they do have a life cycle. Like they do change and they live and then they do die in a sense. And it is, you know, you could think a lot of things. You could think, well, maybe there's a time limit on the dark matter. Like it, over time, it does dissipate so that it can, what ultimately happens is just sink into nothing. Like, does the galaxy just become a black hole at the end, or what happens to it?
Well, they don't know. No. I mean, yeah. At the end, either it starts to fracture because the forces holding it together break apart. Right now they're observing two galaxies running into each other. And so they actually collided with each other, but they seem to be moving through each other,
right?
Which is interesting as well. So, as you said, this is all a theory. There is no possible way to back this up other than this is the best we know of at the moment.
Yeah.
What's really interesting, I think, is that with dark matter, scientists know there's something else there that they can't explain with physical things. With physical explanations, laws, power, or forces. But there's something else there, making sure the universe is shaped a certain way, that things are moving at the right speed, and that basically a galaxy is shaped a certain way because of that unobservable force that they know is out there. And I think that's just really interesting to think about, that probably the biggest impact on why the universe is the way it is something that humans can't detect. And I think that should probably make us think about it. Maybe there's something beyond the physical that's shaping everything.
Yeah, it's amazing. It reminds me sort of, I had one class on these sort of subjects in college, and it was fascinating. So much of it was above, I think, most of our heads, even the professors, I think. but he was a real sharp guy, and he had a PhD in astrophysics, so that sounds great. And he was a smart guy, too. But some of the times he would get into some of these things, it's just amazing. You know, I don't know that I understand it, but it's just fascinating to look at. And I remember them talking about neutrinos. I don't know if you've kind of heard of those, but
yes.
it's the mass of a neutrino is much smaller than that of any other known elementary particle. And like, they didn't even know they were there, and then they kind of inadvertently found one. I think it had something to do with a salt mine in South Dakota, as weird as that sounds, something like that. I can't remember all they taught us, but there's so many things out there, like a dark matter or even like a neutrino or something, to where they don't know what, you know, they didn't know what it was, or dark matter, they don't know what it is or who controls it or how it works and all that. And the more you get into that, the more it points back to an intelligent creator. It just does. And yeah. So it I think it's fascinating. And it's, even though they don't know exactly why this is happening, I think it's great to look at it, because it does show you there is some, it's not just random. There is some power that is controlling things out there. And people would debate what that power is, but a lot of people, self included, would say it's a creator God that made things that way. So yeah. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's definitely an observable pattern that they don't know why it happened, but we can recognize patterns, even though we can't explain why they're there or what's causing the pattern. And I think that that should cause us pause to really think about the bigger picture, because as you said, all these things point to something much more intelligent than us, much more intelligent than chance creating everything. And even this last week I saw, or I guess earlier this week I saw a video, they're comparing the smallest known thing to the universe, basically the size we know it. And it goes through 3D models comparing everything from the smallest particle to the biggest scale. And it's just amazing to see the difference in size. And the smallest particle, I think it's neutrino, or they might have a different name for it now, but it's 10 quintillion times smaller than the next known particle. So in between, they have no idea what's there. There's probably things we don't know about yet. But the smallest particle we can detect is 10 quintillion times smaller than the next biggest one. And then those are still much, much, much smaller than like protons and neutrons that make up an atom. So it's just unbelievable. The infinite minuteness that creation has in it. And we don't know why those particles arrange that way and why they make up everything.
Fascinating. I thought you were going to say Quentin Tarantino there for a minute. It's hard to say.
That would be a good movie, though.
He should do a space documentary.
Yeah.
His name suggests it. Really fascinating write up there. You can read more of that. register.co.uk. Dark matter drought hits older galaxies. So pretty interesting there. You've got some interesting history for us here, too. As mentioned earlier at thetrumpet.com, there's a video up. It's a kind of a new format, I guess. Trumpet Talk, it's called. Discussion, Scotland's referendum and the end of Britain. So this is a big topic that's in the news right now. And you want to take a few minutes and take a look at some of the history between Scotland and England, a long, tumultuous history between those two nations.
Yeah, because with the independence referendum in Scotland coming up again, I think in a year and a half or something like that, Scotland might want, or at least the SNP, the Scottish National Party, wants to break away from the United Kingdom and become their own country again. And this might seem shocking or annoying to the people, depending how they look at it, but it's not really a big surprise if you look at the history between the two countries, between England and Scotland, because it is a long, tumultuous history full of wars and conflict. And I think what's most interesting is that Scotland has actually a huge role in the identity of the British Empire, of Great Britain, even in the formation of the monarchy, of the House of Windsor that we have today. Scotland all plays an integral role in that. So I think this independence referendum and Scotland breaking away, it's not just about Scotland and economics and the laws and all that stuff. It's actually about a lot more. It's about tradition. It's about the identity of not only Great Britain, but of all the peoples living across the world. As I think Brad McDonald brings out in his article, more Scottish people live outside of Scotland than inside of it during the great days of immigration. They live in across the world. The Scotland that we know today is a product of them being a part of the British Empire. And when you look at the many conflicts and everything, it's really interesting to see that without England, without that union, the Act of Union 1707 is what brought the two countries together to create the United Kingdom. Without that act of union, Scotland would have remained, as Neil Ferguson called it, the Belarus of the West, a small backwater country, not a lot of resources, proud traditions, but no platform in which to become great. And the platform where the Scots really made a difference was in Britain. Adam Smith, a Scotsman, invented capitalism. You had the Scottish Highlanders were probably the most famous and fierce soldiers of the British Empire. They're the ones who won the Battle of Waterloo, some say, and other famous battles in history. And so without them being united, the world as we know it would be a lot different. And it all started in this act of union in 1707.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So what they want, or a lot of people want, I guess, is to just break away from the UK and be their own independent group, but I guess go more towards the EU as well.
Yeah.
That's their beef, if you want to call it that. They're more interested in the European Union than they are in sticking with Britain there in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, Britain is long past its glory. There is no empire anymore. It itself is vulnerable. Having to choose between the United States and a European trading bloc. And so the UK itself is in a difficult position. And so if Scotland leaves, it makes England smaller. The big thing, too, with this is that Scotland has the Trident missiles, the nuclear missiles, and other important military infrastructure that England uses, including the big docks in North Scotland, which house the British fleet. So if Scotland breaks away, it's not just a divorce, as David Cameron said it, between two peoples. It also can impact Britain's military capacity, where they're going to house their navy. All these different things playing a role in it too. And so with this feud going on, it's actually Scotland and England had been fighting against each other longer than they've been united. So in our recent history, of course, we think of them as one country. But ever since the days of Hadrian, the Roman emperor in about 1100, when he went to Britain and built the big wall there, Scotland and England had been fighting against each other. So it goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. And for Scotland, the main reason why they became united and the big aggression between the two countries was over the throne. That's where the struggle started, which I think is interesting. That today, that no one, I think the throne of England is forgotten about. It doesn't play a big role in society. But at that time, back just to 1600s, 1700s, the whole struggle between Scotland and England was about the throne. Whose dynasty would sit on that throne? English kings or Scottish kings? And they were eventually united into one in the Act of Union, 1707. But after that, the Princess Sophia of the Hanover, of the German house, came over and she and her family became kings and queens. And then so the Scottish kings were kind of put off to the side. And so I think what's interesting is that the feud originally was over something of royal majesty. It wasn't over economics and that what we have today. And perhaps the most unifying force in England is that throne. But that's the thing that they forget about the most.
Yeah, well, in some cases, I don't know what the perception is over there, but it seems like there is a little bit of even embarrassment about it to some extent. I mean, even here in the U.S., there is embarrassment about, say, the greatness of the U.S. over the years, or the founding fathers, or you know, this idea that we're a force for good in the world, and the, you know, the patriarchs and all that. That it's something that it seems to come up at least with some people in the media or in education, where they're embarrassed by that. And so I don't know if the same feeling goes to the throne there, but it seems like there is sort of this a shame of the history, and it's been really good history for the most part, but people are sort of embarrassed or ashamed about it today.
Yeah, well, I think for Scotland, the Stone of Scone, and that is a symbol of their nationalism. It's a symbol of their independence to have that stone. Even when Edward I in 1296, he conquered Scotland and he took the stone to England. Edward hated Scottish traditions. He had no respect for them. He took the stone not really out of any respect to it, but rather just to show the Scots that you are subjugated. And so even the transfer of that throne and that stone was done in a very bitter atmosphere. And for the Scots, the stone is more of a symbol of who they are. for the English, it's not really the stone, I think, is the big deal for them. It's the person on the throne, like the that the king or the queen represents the vast British Empire. So I think there's a different way how people view it, and I think it is an embarrassment because today any links to some kind of religious past or some kind of ties to ancient traditions are scorned at because we're in this progressive age where one race or one family isn't exalted above anyone else. Everyone's kind of the same and every culture is equal and all that. But if you look at their past, they thought very differently. And so I think they try to distance themselves from what they think is xenophobic, racist, sexist, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's definitely a changing mentality about those things. There's a lot of good information at thetrumpet.com on this topic today. Trumpet Talk discussion, Scotland's referendum and the end of Britain. You can watch that there. That's a video right on the front page. Also some related stories. Scotland to hold another independence referendum by Richard Palmer. And the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Silly Dove, as Britain negotiates EU exit, the SNP calls for Scottish independence. And so those are some good programs and videos and write-ups that will help you understand what's going on over there. Because over here, we don't get a lot of coverage in the U.S. on that. Maybe a passing note, but there's a lot to it. There's a lot of depth there, and it is important. So make sure you check that out at thetrumpet.com. That's all there today. That'll do it for us here on Trumpet Radio Live. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, and Abraham Blondeau, thanks for joining us today. Have a great rest of your Thursday, and we'll talk to you tomorrow here on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.